You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious. Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Lynn and Jordan. Hope you've had a good weekend. Looking forward to a great week ahead. Hope you got to a farmer's market this weekend. I only made it to one this week, just like last week, but I went to the Sebastopol one today, and it was just wonderful. We're starting to see more produce. Farmers are, you know, coming out of that really difficult wet period from March when so many lost crops, but it was really just a beautiful day at the market. And before I introduce our guests, I should tell you that there is a new feature, I think I mentioned this last week, at Eat This Now, my blog. It is called Fresh From Our Farmers, and then with the name of a town afterwards. It launched with Fresh From Our Farmers, Santa Rosa, and now Sebastopol is also up. And you'll find it in two places, at both the Eat This Now blog, but also in the town section of the Press Democrat. It also appears that it will be running inside the food section on Wednesdays because my editor likes it so much. And I try to go into lots of detail. The first ones have been very general, but general in the sense that it's a roundup with lots of specifics about the markets. And then as the season continues, I'll be focusing on this farmer, that farmer, and trying to give exposure to people who don't necessarily get a lot of exposure. So if you read them, if you got something to say, please leave a comment, because, you know, comments really drive blogs. And I may be the only, I don't know, we've got someone here who also writes a blog. I'm going to ask her. Sometimes I think I'm the only person on the planet who corrects the grammar, spelling, and punctuation of the comments that are left. It's just one of the things that drives me nuts when I read other blogs. And I decided, okay, nobody gets to be snarky in their comments. If somebody's snarky, I just don't approve it. And I'm going to make it grammatically correct and pleasing to look at. So that's the rule for Eat This Now. And on that note, I want to introduce my guests. We have Meredith Kahn, who, if I have it right, you are a rabbinical intern for Congregation Shomrei Torah.
Yes.
Yay, I did it right. Thank you so much for being here. Really, really appreciate that you were able to take a Sunday evening to join us.
My pleasure.
I also have joining us for at least the third time my friend and colleague Stephanie Rosenbaum, who writes a blog for KQED, has written a number of books, including the Astrology Cookbook, which was so much fun. Thanks for driving up from Oakland.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
And we're talking about Passover, the first night of which is tomorrow.
Monday night.
Great. Well, let's just jump right in. It's starting on a new year. I mean, on a full moon.
Starts on a full moon. The first, the 14th day of the month of Nisan, which happens every year in the spring. When exactly it coincides with the American calendar is different, but it's always in the spring because we make sure of that.
Mm-hmm. So it will range from what sort of the
sort of March to April.
March to April.
Because the Jewish calendar, the months are 30 days, and so that would only be 360 and you'd mm-hmm. lose all those 5 days. Mm-hmm. So every so often we add a whole new month in 2 months before Passover.
Oh, okay.
To make it all work, because you don't want the spring holiday to happen in the fall, and you don't want fall holidays to happen in the spring.
Okay, so you just add something every now and then.
Yeah.
Well, that's convenient. Yeah. That's so sensible. And what's the, to sum it up really quickly, for somebody who, you know, just came from another planet, how would you tell them what Passover is, either of you?
So Passover is the celebration that marks the Jews' liberation from slavery in Egypt, going back to the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. We were slaves, and now we're free. And each of us is supposed to consider as though we had been slaves and are free now. And some of the traditions go back to 3,000 years, definitely 2,000 years, and people keep updating it and bringing it to be relevant to our time. And so it's a specific ritual meal with a lot of leeway about how you do it, but there are some things to have a kosher Passover you have to do.
You have to do certain things.
Yeah.
You have to eat certain things, and you have to do certain things.
And you have to not eat
And you have to things. Not eat certain things uh-huh. as well. And it's also interesting. I was at Berkeley Bowl today, and it was jammed. And the woman was sitting next behind me, and she was like, is it always like this on Sunday? I said, no, it's Passover tomorrow. I said, it's a little like Jewish Thanksgiving. You know, if you're going to have a lot of people over, and you're going to cook. And there's actually something that says, let all who are hungry come and eat. That's part of it. Anybody that calls you and says, I want to come to your house for Passover, you have to let them.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Absolutely. You can't. You're even supposed to sort of lay a place for a stranger there. I've had people who call me, and they may not even be Jewish, but maybe their partner's Jewish, or they have just been to Seder's before and they like them. And I've had 15 people in a studio apartment, because you can't turn anyone away.
No, it lasts for 8 days.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Do you eat a big meal every night?
No, there's a Seder the first night and the second night, depending upon...
Okay, the Seder is the name of the meal.
Yes. It actually, Seder means order, and there's a specific order in which you go through the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And you have those the first night and the second night. Some people have more. Some people have some just before Passover to get them in the mood, but then you kind of get overwhelmed and tired of them. So the first two, very special.
Okay. And I know you've been cooking. You're having a Seder for 50?
Yes. Not me personally. A friend of mine belongs to, it's kind of a spiritual organization. And she's that kind of does a little bit of every tradition. I have to say it's one of those blender spiritualities. But anyway, she's been very involved with it. And her partner is Jewish. And so she wanted to bring a Seder to this community. And she asked me if I would be interested in doing the food. And I said, sure. So she actually put together a Haggadah, which is it's the sort of book you read. It tells the story of the Exodus from Egypt. It has the prayers, and it goes through kind of all the ritual. And there's a million of them. That's the really fun part, is that there are Marxist Haggadahs. There are feminist Haggadahs. There are very traditional ones. There are very modern ones. You can, I sort of wrote my own, you know, using different texts. There's a million of them, because that's sort of the Jewish tradition of, as long as it's kind of rooted in the old tradition, you can interpret it any way you want. So she's writing her own Haggadah, and I am, cooking for 50, because it turned out to be incredibly popular, because there turned out to be very many Jews in that congregation who had kind of felt they'd lost touch with tradition, and they didn't really want to go and do a very traditional Jewish Seder, but they all of a sudden were excited about the thought of having a Passover. So, mm-hmm.
Now, Meredith, you have your family?
Yeah, we have a family Haggadah, and Haggadah means the telling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we started doing it because we looked at all these other mm-hmm. Haggadahs and went,
right.
And they just didn't speak to us.
Right.
And so we've been developing it and changing it every mm-hmm. year to, this worked, this yeah. didn't work. I just learned this incredible thing. Let's
right.
throw that in. And so we do that.
That's so interesting. What are you cooking for the 50 people?
Well, you know, there has to be matzo ball soup, which is, you know, we're doing a chicken one and a vegetarian one, but it's going to have matzo balls, which are sort of a light dumpling that are made with matzo meal. Yeah. Because
now, why does there have to be matzo ball soup?
Because it's tradition.
Okay.
Because my grandmother, okay. may she rest in peace, you know, she would have a fit if I didn't make it.
Okay.
And my daughter thinks that it is not Passover
unless they have matzo ball soup. Okay. Because there's the you want to talk about the dietary restrictions that go with Passover?
Well, you can't ever have food. Bread. No bread.
Nothing leavened.
Nothing leavened. Although, actually, the New York Times ran an amazing article about 3 years ago about how you can use baking powder.
You could use chemical leavening, but I just don't.
It seem kosher.
Right. It doesn't, exactly.
It doesn't work. You have to let go of anything that ever rose. Mm-hmm. And you can't even, you can make cakes, but you have to use flour that used to, well, you have to use matzah meal that was
baked.
Matzah
right.
That's crumbled up.
Oh, great. So that it can't leaven, naturally ferment. Nothing that can naturally ferment on its own. So no grain, no wheat, no grain, no rice, no corn, no...
That's, of course, controversial. The Sephardic
Jews
use rice.
Right, exactly, but...
Interesting.
But generally no grains, and then if you're coming from an Eastern European tradition, no legumes.
Yeah.
And then if you're coming from a Sephardic, more North African, Middle Eastern tradition, then they're slightly different. But in general, nothing, definitely no bread, nothing leavened mm-hmm. is the big one.
Are there other restrictions?
No, the big one. No grain, no leavening.
So there's this Jewish concept from the rabbis of 2,000 years ago that you have to build a fence around the regulations because you want to make sure that you really don't screw up. So for example, people will say you can't have corn, which makes no sense to me personally because there was no corn in the Middle East. That would leave out corn, anything made with corn syrup. Anything that has corn anywhere in it.
And confectioner's sugar that has cornstarch in it.
And then presumably, if you're really traditional or you really care, you want to make sure you buy products that are kosher for Passover.
Okay. Yeah.
And that means that the factory has cleaned out anything that could possibly have leavening in it. And so major spring cleaning, and that a rabbi who's trained has checked and made sure it's completely kosher for Passover.
Mm-hmm. So there's a really wide range of observance. You can be extremely strict and extremely observant and clean everything up. My grandmother, for example, was Orthodox, and so she had separate dishes for Passover.
Right, I've heard of that.
So she had meat and dairy dishes that were her Passover set, so that when Passover came, clean out all the cabinets, everything, and then replace, bring in different dishes.
You don't have to be Orthodox for that. We grew up conservative and we did that.
Right.
And then you have your good dishes and your good meat dishes and your good dairy dishes.
Or, there's a lot of restaurants that are doing Passover-inspired dishes for the holiday. So they may not, they're not kosher for Passover, but they're doing, Delfina's doing Italian, San Francisco is doing Italian Jewish food. Mm-hmm. So is, I believe, Per Bacco. They're doing a dinner with Joyce Goldstein, and she's making Italian Jewish, things. So, and now a lot of people are getting into the edible Seder plate. So there's the farm egg, and there's the yummy herb salad, and there's, different interpretations. There might be, someone was saying like lamb shank crostini on matzah, So you can do a lot
you
of...
You have a lot of latitude.
You have a lot of latitude. This being the Bay Area, people tend to really interpret it the way they want, they wish.
And I should add that we also have with us my engineer tonight, Eric Black. Eric, you can mic yourself and join in this conversation whenever you want. Eric is going to do a blessing at the appropriate time, which you guys will be deciding, not me, because I don't know. Anyway, I know that you know a lot about this. You've lived in Israel for a while as well, Eric. So just join in the conversation however you like.
Okay.
It's a really joyful holiday, and it's very family-oriented. Unlike some other holidays, it's really less about spending time in a synagogue as it is spending time with family, and you're really mandated to pass this story on to your children, and that's a big part of it.
In fact, one of the laws is that you're supposed to, there's this moment when your child is supposed to ask you, mm-hmm. and therefore, we have the four questions, which maybe Eric would also like to say, but that if the child doesn't have sufficient understanding, it's actually the parent's responsibility to model how to ask questions. And we want the children engaged from the beginning with whatever questions they have that hopefully will get answered during the
So it's a way
process.
To pass the heritage.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think a lot of people come back to a Seder, want to come to Passover because they remember it, hopefully as a good thing, but they remember it from their childhood. And even if they don't remember the story too much, you remember some of the story and you remember the really yummy food you had. Mm-hmm.
And you remember the wine that you got to drink.
Manischewitz. That gets really sweet. Yeah, you get to, or grape juice, but, or wine, but you get to drink the wine. You get to find the bread. broken matzah. You get to find the afikoman. You get to have your grandma's gefilte fish.
And you sing Dayenu.
You sing Dayenu, which, you know.
It's a song. It's like this quintessential Jewish song. In reverse, it's, you know, if God had only done this for us, if God had only brought us out of Egypt, that would have been enough. If God had only given us the Torah, that would have been enough. If God had only, you know, brought us to the promised land, that would have been enough. And it's like every step along the way. And then there's this great chorus that gets really old, but is, should we all do it? Die, die, enu, die, die, enu,
die, die, enu, die, enu, die, enu. And that can go on for a really long time, depending on how much wine everyone has had. But it's a celebration of abundance and thanks and gratitude.
Now, does it have any, you may, before we went on the air, you mentioned it's a little, or maybe after, you mentioned it's a little bit like Jewish Thanksgiving. Everyone's shopping. Mm-hmm. Does it have anything, any resonance with New Year's? Because one of the things you're saying, you clean your cupboards, spring, rebirth, and not so much American New Year's, Western, but I was thinking Lunar. And one of the things you do for Lunar New Year is you clean your kitchen, for example. So I'm just wondering if there's any resonance.
Well, the cleaning your kitchen is like the one of the major steps that you have to do. And there's this incredible ritual before Passover actually happens that's written in the Mishnah, which is the commentary after the Torah that's like 2,000 years old, where you're supposed to go around with a candle and a feather to make sure you've gotten every last crumb. And I know people who start cleaning their kitchens 3 weeks in advance.
I'd like to invite someone, if they don't have a kitchen to clean and they need to, they can come to my house. No problem.
And it's called chametz, is the stuff that is anything leavened, any, you know, little Cheerios, little scraps of, you know, flour.
And so you're sweeping out
anything leavened.
And you're actually supposed to remove from your house your cupboards, anything.
Yeah, like there's a sort of ritual sales, like you sell it to somebody for a penny or something, you know, or something like that.
So like the yeast that you keep in your freezer has to go.
Everything. The wontons in your freezer, you know, the spring rolls, you know, anything.
The flour,
the bacon, yeah, all that.
All this.
The pasta, the everything.
So what's this symbolizing?
Well, it's one of the ways, well, first of all, the leavening was because when we left Egypt, when the last plague happened and the firstborn son was killed and Pharaoh said, get out of here, we left, we presumably only had enough time to bake something that wouldn't rise. So that's
so
the
mix,
biblical.
Mix the dough.
You mix the dough.
But bake it on a hot rock and you're out of
hit
there.
The road. So that's the biblical thing. Mm-hmm. The spiritual message is that to be able to let go of anything that is arrogant in you.
That puffs you up. Vanity.
Interesting. I never knew that. That's really interesting.
All that stuff. And I think it's also, it's sort of purification and it's, you know, starting clean. I mean, it doesn't really have anything to do with New Year because there's a Jewish New Year that happens usually around September.
Although Nisan is the first month of the year.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Weirdly
I didn't
enough,
know that.
Yes. In the Torah, when they list the holidays, Nisan is the first month of the year.
Right. So, and just like Aries is the first, you know, of the astrological calendar. But and it definitely, there's a lot of spring resonance. There's a lot of things you have with these special, you have spring greens, you know, you have egg, there's a lot of, it definitely is connected with the spring rituals.
Yeah, so there's a Seder plate that holds the ritual items, and two of them are definitely completely related to spring and nothing else particularly. There's fresh greens, fresh parsley, and the egg.
And how is the egg?
A roasted
egg.
Yeah. Although some people just boil it.
Okay. But.
That almost seems like a little, I've heard people say it's a little bit of a pagan holdover. It's, you know, just like eggs and Easter. You know, it's a celebration of new life, spring, the chickens start laying again, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the circularity of life. You know.
And then there's also part of the beginning of the Exodus story is that the midwives were the first resistance against the Pharaoh and oppression. And so midwives, eggs go together really well.
Interesting.
And then some of the other items that are on the plate is a thing called the haroset, which is it's supposed to represent the mortar that the slaves had to use between the bricks to build the pyramids. But because we are free now, we make it out of something sweet. And so definitely in the Eastern European tradition, it's made of walnuts and apples and honey and cinnamon and sweet wine. And then in the Sephardic tradition, it's often made with dry fruit,
dates,
you know, dried apricots, honey, spices, things like that.
And you
that.
Just took something out of your bag, Meredith.
My family herosis, which we make the Sephardic version
because
got so bored
with the Ashkenazi
version. And so we had dates and lots of different dried fruits, apples, oranges.
Oh, wonderful.
This is very different than the one that I've seen. Very different. This looks good.
Oh, I love it.
It is.
And it smells wonderful. Let's let Erica.
Yum.
And you put that on matzah, sometimes with a little horseradish.
Yeah. During the Seder, it actually, first you, there's also bitter herbs because we're supposed to remember the bitterness
of slavery. Right.
Or the bitterness that you still experience.
I just took a little, but put a little on my palm. That is really good.
Thank you.
Really nice.
And
can I try some? It looks great.
You have as much. And we make it a few days ahead so that the flavors really sink together.
This looks great.
And
I think we're throwing around these terms Ashkenazi and Sephardic, and maybe we should go over what those
are.
Please,
could you explain?
That's a very good point. Thank you.
Ashkenazi is Eastern European, Caucasian. It has become kind of the dominant
paradigm version
of Judaism that exists within the world and that is most commonly practiced, probably because white Western people have come to dominate the world.
Mm-hmm. That's actually not true entirely. Okay. Part of it is because 25 million of us came from Russia. You know, there were 25 million Jews coming from Russia who were Ashkenazi, let alone the rest of Eastern Europe. And so it was that we were the most...
It's just numbers, you're saying.
Yeah. Part of it was
in this country.
Just numbers. You have to. In this country. And, you know, 25 million, there have never been so many Jews that, you know, 25 million wouldn't be a significant number.
So 25 million from Russia.
Yeah.
I've always thought that my grandfather was probably a Russian Jew. He died when my mother was a toddler. And so he was a doctor in Russia. And he took a different name to come here.
Mm-hmm.
But his first name was Samuel, and his middle name was Boris. And his Russian name might have been Kazakov or Kazakovsky. And I don't know, but I just thought, it sounds Jewish to me. I don't know. But for what it's worth.
So Mizrahi and Sephardic is the other version of Judaism, which I think those terms are used pretty much interchangeably.
The first word again?
Mizrahi.
Oh, Mizrahi, okay.
Which means east.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or Sephardic, sometimes it's called. Sephardic has the root of that word in Hebrew means from Spain. So it's basically Jews from Spain or from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And
North Africa.
And North Africa, right. So it's kind of like... Jewish Arabs, although you think of Jews and Arabs as basically mutually exclusive groups. In the Arab world, Jews have traditionally lived for thousands of years until the rise of Zionism, when basically Jews either left or were kicked out of the Arab world. So there's all different traditions and practices and ideologies that come from that world as opposed to the Western world, because it's just the difference between the East and the West. So there's, like you said, what's an example? Rice or beans, I think.
Rice
Eastern people
rice.
Don't eat beans or they do eat beans on Passover. Ashkenazi people, Western people don't.
Yeah. Right.
And there's all sorts of versions of that.
We embrace our inner Sephardi on Passover, even though we're Ashkenazi.
We'll always go with the more liberal, lax policy, obviously.
And some people think the food is a lot better. It's spicier. It's, you know, it's a little more... The Sephardic cuisine. It's, you know, a little bit more Mediterranean. It's, you know, all that yummy stuff.
Now, what's dominant in Israel?
I think that Mizrahim or Sephardim are actually numerically the majority in Israel, but Ashkenazim are culturally dominant as far as the culture of the society and the politics of the society. Mm-hmm. But numerically, there are a lot of... people that we don't consider that wouldn't fit the stereotype of Jews because they're dark skinned. They have brown skin. They're from the Arab world. They don't look like the Jews that are portrayed in Woody Allen movies. They look and act very differently.
Uh-huh.
And the stereotype is kind of like the Jewish New Yorker in the Woody Allen movie, right? Me too. I'm also from New York, so
New Jersey. So.
There you go. Right,
so. but there are Jews everywhere. There are Jews in India. There are Jews in Ethiopia. There's Jews, you know. There's Jews in Mexico. You really can't. It's hard to find a culture where there isn't some little pocket of, you know, Jews who ended up there for one reason or another.
Well, let's go back to the Seder because we were on the matzo ball soup and went down another avenue.
Right.
So what else is tradition? I mean, but we the Harris.
So the Seder plate has okay. on it, and Rabban Gamliel, who was the leader of the Jewish people around 200 CE, used to say the only way to have a kosher Seder, you had to be able to explain the matzah, which we've already explained, the Passover offering, which is generally the lamb shank, although in my family it's the beet. And
we do a Paschal yam instead of the Paschal lamb.
And the bitter herbs, which we've also discussed. So the lamb shank is from the biblical interpretation of that is for the last plague. We had to actually slaughter a lamb, put the blood over the lintel so that the angel of death would miss us.
Would pass over
us literally.
Oh, so it was because of a plague.
So it was about the plague of the death of the firstborn. And it was the only plague for which the Jews had to take an active part. We had, you know, everything else, they just passed over us. We were in Goshen. Everything was okay. But for the last plague, we had to stand up and say, you know, count me in. And the sheep, the ram was a sacred animal to the Egyptians. And so by us killing a lamb, we were basically thumbing our noses at Pharaoh. So it was this real act of bravery to do that.
Really interesting. I saw a movie when I was very, very young that had something to do with lambs and killing the firstborn son.
Is it the Ten Commandments?
No, I think it might have been King of Kings, maybe. My mother hauled me, the minister gave her tickets, and she hauled me there. I had nightmares for decades. Decades, but they painted blood on the door, and there were soldiers putting knives into what looked to me very much like babies. I was just horrified. And I've also always associated Passover with something to do with that, though I've never really investigated. You know, I was much too young to really understand what was going on. It was horrific.
I can imagine.
It was, so it's a plague that, okay. That's interesting.
That we were protected against.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's
good. When my daughter became a bat mitzvah, this was her Torah portion, and she was a vegetarian from the age of 5, and she was so appalled that what would make her a Jew was killing an animal. And so from that year forward, and she's 29 now, we use a beet because instead of the Paschal yam, the beet looks
like blood. Yeah, right. That works. Mm-hmm. That works. Well, I've also had a blood orange on my Seder plate sometimes because there was a famous, possibly apocryphal, but who knows, story that a woman asked a very traditional rabbi, you know, when will women be able to become rabbis, be up on the bima, which is sort of the sort of altar of the. And he said, oh, a woman belongs on the bima like an orange on a Seder plate. And so then from sort of feminist, and now it's become kind of common, like people actually started putting oranges on their Seder plate.
So that story comes from Susanna Heschel, who's the daughter of Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's a professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth. And she came to the Women's Seder at Road of Shalom at some point and gave us the real story because it's such a shocking difference. She went to a Seder at Oberlin. There was a lesbian Seder, and they put bread on their Seder plate to mark the way that they've been marginalized from the Jewish community. And she thought noticing the marginalization made a lot of sense, but you can't put bread on a Seder plate. Right. So she came up with the idea of an orange because, you know, it has the seeds inside for rebirth, and she extended it to sort of anyone who's been marginalized besides gays and lesbians, and that the seeds were really cool because you could spit them out. And she made some comment about, you know, isn't it interesting that she came up with this and it, you know, suddenly the words came out of a man's mouth in the apocryphal
version.
That's really
funny. I didn't know that at all. But I liked putting a blood orange because that also seemed very, you know, appropriate.
So this year we have always had an orange on our Seder plate, and we finally started having people eating the orange. And this year we're putting dark chocolate, fair trade organic on our Seder plate because a friend of mine wrote this blog in which she was saying, we don't support slavery anymore. And when you think about how much chocolate comes from the Ivory Coast, not just slave labor, but child slave labor. Yeah. And so unless you buy fair trade organic, you're supporting slavery. And so we thought, dark chocolate, orange together.
There you go. Eric, you're vegetarian these days. I don't know how long you've been one. So for you, what would replace the lamb shank in your Seder?
Well, I have to confess that since I stopped living with my parents, I've been a little bit lax on doing the Seders. So I haven't, I don't have a family. I haven't made a Seder. Mm-hmm. So it's a issue. I'm getting some good ideas here. I can go with the orange. I can roll like that, right.
And beets are really wonderful right now.
Right. So there you go. It's the first time I've heard of people right. switching out the, I haven't done a Seder with vegetarians, so I don't know.
I've done vegetarian Seders and they're really fun because especially when you make a really good vegetable broth, you know, like a garlic-based broth, and you make your matzo balls, you know, not with the chicken fat, but just with, you know, oil or something, people are so excited by the fact that they can eat something that pretty much, and you put enough garlic and dill in your soup, it's going to taste like chicken soup. And so people are really excited. They get to have some reasonable facsimile of, you know, matzo ball soup on Passover. So they're really, really excited. And so I've done vegetarian Seders a lot, and they're actually really fun.
Actually, you know what I did last year? I made an except. I ate matzo ball soup that was cooked with chicken in it because
right.
I was just trying to go with the flow and observe the tradition. And I was at like a Seder and I wasn't going to make a scene of myself.
Yeah,
it's just better. It wasn't that important.
It's often
definitely.
The right way to go. Definitely. You know, there's been, I don't know if alternative Jewish community, and by I don't mean alternative to anything Jewish. I mean just, you know, like West County people. There was a big community that was sort of gathered by Mickey, who founded Infusion Tea Room. She was wonderful. She and her husband and children were from Israel. They moved here. She started bringing in amazing organic teas. And for all Jewish holidays, they would have these West County style celebrations. Unfortunately for us, not for Mickey and her family, they just decided they wanted to continue raising their children in Israel, and they moved back. But I know that that community is still there in Western Sonoma County, and it would probably be a really good one for you to. Maybe somebody will be listening and they'll send us an email and you can meet some of these people.
Yeah, no, I went to a West County style celebration of Rosh Hashanah, the new year, in Redwoods Grove up there in Guerneville. It was like when I first got to Sonoma County last year. And, you know, it's very changing the tradition and allowing the tradition to evolve or evolving it. But there's Judaism is very dynamic. People we were talking about this off the air before we started that. People are changing the words to the traditional prayers so that they sound less misogynistic, so that they sound more inclusive, so that they sound more spiritual.
More universal.
More universal, et cetera, because ultimately a lot of these prayers were written hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, and they're, you know, there's not...
They resonate in a different way.
Yeah, there's not much mention of Facebook and Twitter in these prayers. You know, it's just, it's not talking to us, you know, so we need to make it evolve. And that's happening all over the place. It's happening here. I knew tons of people in Israel that were doing it, so it's always happening.
How long did you live in Israel?
3.5 years.
What were you doing?
I was, on a simple level, I was working in a restaurant. I had a bunch of jobs, but I worked in a restaurant for 2 years, a vegetarian restaurant, actually a vegan restaurant, which has just started up there. Veganism is much newer out there than it is over here. And my boss, my former boss, was spearheading it. So I was doing that, and I was learning to speak a foreign language, which is fun and earth-shattering within my own personal world because you go from being, you know, I was basically learning to live in a different culture. It's very powerful. Yeah.
Well, good for you for doing that.
And an awesome falafel, I bet.
Incredible. Hummus and sabah. It's just that sabah is the underrated alternative version to hummus, which people, do you know about it, Michelle?
No, please.
It's... I think it's just in Palestine, you know, so Israelis have been exposed to it, and now it's Israeli, because I also traveled in Jordan and Syria, and I did not see it there, but it's, you basically have your prepared hummus that's ready, right? Then you add tahina, and you add some of your cooked garbanzo beans that you didn't yet mix into your hummus, and then you slow cook that. You put that on a very low flame and you let that sit. But you don't mix in the tahina with the hummus, even though there's tahina in the hummus.
Oh, you add more.
You add more and you don't mix it in. So it becomes this very like liquidy hummus. And then it's all about how you spice it. There's this one place right down the street from where I lived, which is famous in Tel Aviv for having the best masabaha. And it is just so incredibly good.
Interesting.
But it is heavy.
I love hummus. I love making my own hummus.
But I've never heard of it being cooked. So then it's slow cooked. So does it cook down?
Well, I tried to make it, and I don't have the secret recipe. So, I mean, I tried to make it from what I found on the web.
Right.
People talking about it. There's actually a hummus blog. Have you ever been to it?
No.
Yeah, there's a hummus blog.
It might, of course there is.
Yeah. So I was getting all these ideas, and I tried to do it, but mine, because I just don't think I know what spices and the ratios and everything. But yeah, it cooks down a little bit. It's going to solidify, obviously, if it's on a flame a little bit, but you add a lot of tahini at the beginning so that it's very runny.
Right.
And this is the next stage beyond hummus, you know.
Right, right. It's hummus 2.0.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Well, I'm still falafel is beyond me. I just was cooking for a whole large group last week, and I decided to make my own falafel, and made the little balls. It looked beautiful, and then I put them in the oil and they exploded.
Oh no.
It was I made falafel hash though, because I just decided, you know, what do you like about falafel? It's, you know, moist inside, it's crunchy. I was like, you know, it's fine. I don't have to have the perfect little balls. I just put it in big pans, and I did it as hash.
That's a great save.
Right.
It's really a great save.
I had 45 people waiting to have lunch. I was like, I had to make something. It was either going to be pita bread and peanut butter, or it was going to be falafel hash.
You made the right choice.
Yeah, falafel hash worked better.
Let's move on to the wine. Because it's not literally, I didn't bring any.
Darn, right.
So sorry. But what is the role, what role does wine play in the Seder?
We have 4 cups that represent all sorts of things, including that God saved us with an outstretched hand and
a mighty
arm and like all sorts of other things. And so throughout the Seder, we have a cup here, a cup there, 2 before dinner, 2 after dinner. Mm-hmm. And the first one, because we start almost every holiday, any sacred time, with wine, mm-hmm. because it's celebration.
Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't have to be like Menashevitz,
well,
does it?
It is supposed to be not just kosher, but kosher for Passover, and I can't actually figure out how wine. My understanding, and I actually had this, I was at some little workshop with the head of Hagafen, mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if this is polite to say, but my understanding of how he explained it was what makes wine kosher is that Orthodox men do certain parts of the process. So if you want to support that, you buy kosher wine.
I see.
And if you don't, you don't.
Okay.
But there are, so the Manischewitz, you know, that's made with Concord grape wine, the same grapes that you know, Welch's grape jelly, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So it's very heavy. It's very sweet. Some people really like it because it's traditional. It's what they grew up with, you know, and other people say, oh my gosh, please do not make me drink that, you know, awful, awful stuff. It's, you know, kids like it because it's really sweet. But there are, if you want kosher wine, there are many really
Hagafen wines,
you know, Baron Herzog. There's a lot of
kosher wines out there now.
And actually, some of them are made in Israel, and then some of them are made right here in Northern California. Yeah. So there's definitely a lot of options out there.
And the kids, is there a certain age at which the kids participate? You said 8 years old.
Or you know, well, it's always, in terms of the drinking the wine, I mean, in my family, when I grew up, we were given the Manischewitz. My daughters drink grape juice.
I grew up with grape juice. So that's a parent decision. But you know, it can be grape juice or it can be wine. That's just up to whenever you decide.
And there's a blessing that one says before the wine. There's a short blessing before each glass, and there's a long blessing that's the first one. And I believe Eric's going to be doing it for us.
Yes, are you ready, Eric?
I think I'm ready to go.
Okay.
Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam bore peri hagafen. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam asher bachar banu mikol Aham, ורוממנו מכל השעון, וקידשנו במצוותיו, ותיתן לנו, אדוני אלוהינו, באהבה, מועדים לשמחה, חגים, וזמנים לששון את יום חג המצות הזה זמן חירותנו מקרא קודש זכר ליציאת מצרים כיוונו בחרת ואותנו קידשת מכל העמים ומועדי קודשך בשמחה ובססון הנחלתנו ברוך אתה אדוני מקדש ישראל והזמנים.
בראשית ברא אלוהים את השמיים, את השמיים ואת הארץ. בראשית ברא אלוהים את השמיים, את השמיים ואת הארץ. והארץ הייתה חושך על פני תהום, ורוח אלוהים מרחפת על פני המים. יאמר אלוהים יהיה ויהי יום, ויאר אלוהים טהור כי טוב, ויאר את האור. ויבדל אלוהים בין האור ובין החושך, ויקרא אלוהים לאור יום, ולחושך קרא לילה. ויבדל אלוהים בין האור ובין החושך, ויקרא אלוהים לאור יום, ולחושך קרא לילה. והארץ הייתה תוהו ובוהו, חושך על פני תהום, ורוח אלוהים מרחפת על פני המים. ויאמר אלוהים יום ויהי יום,
very beautiful blessing from Eric Black, Mouthful's engineer. Thank you so much, Eric. That was really special for us here in the studio, and I hope for you listening at home as well. This is just such a great hour. I should reintroduce my guest. We have with us Stephanie Rosenbaum, a writer, writes a lot about food. Where do people find your blog?
You know, right now they can find it at KQED. If you go to their website, you know, which is the public radio station for San Francisco and the surrounding areas, and if you go to kqed.org/food, you'll find it right there, and the column is called Bay Area Bites. I am one of four Stephanies who blog for it.
Four Stephanies?
Yes, they're actually, and as well as other people, but yes, there are four of us, but, you know, I'm the Jewish one. I'm Stephanie Rosenbaum, and I think I have a column on there today that's about Passover.
Oh, great.
So, yeah, you can always find my work there, and I'm also writing for Edible East Bay.
Great. And Meredith Kahn, you're a rabbinical intern. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means I'm 6 weeks away from being a rabbi, and I have been serving and studying at Congregation Shomrei Torah in Santa Rosa, mm-hmm. and learning a lot from their rabbi, George Gittleman.
How long a process?
It's a five-year process. Uh-huh. It's generally a five-year process. Mm-hmm. It can take more or less, depending mm-hmm. upon how much.
And then once you're a rabbi, what happens?
That's still up in the air.
Okay. Okay. Well, soon, congratulations.
Thank you.
You're coming to the end of a really important occasion, a really important process. So we've really been concentrating on the Seder, which you say the first day?
First two nights.
First two nights
of Passover.
So leftovers for the rest?
Well, so my family, we don't make matzo balls because I make the worst matzo. Not the worst, but I make not good matzo balls. So we found someone who makes unbelievably wonderful matzo balls, and we buy them. And so we have to tell him how many we want. And we're talking we get enough to last us the week. And my husband and daughter are in heaven. And you eat a lot of matzah. The horosis goes a long way.
Right.
People make matzah brei.
Which I despise.
Matzah brei?
Which is, I hate it, but I am really in the minority. Everyone loves it. It's sort of like a cross between so matzah farfel is basically crunched up matzah. It's kind mm-hmm. of matzah in little pieces. And a lot of times people mix that with eggs and kind of make a sort of a, somewhere between French toast and like an omelet with bits of matzah in it. I don't see the appeal, but people adore it and really, really like it.
Okay.
I'm
not sold on the concept.
No, I'm sorry. Your people are going to be lighting up going, I love matzo brei. My grandma's matzo brei. But I actually make matzo rolls using matzo meal and oil and eggs and, you know, cinnamon and stuff like that. And so that they make little, you know, they don't exactly puff, but they're, you know, mm-hmm. like little roll type things. And I sort of have that with jam and, you know, I have that for breakfast. But really by the end of it, the end of Passover, everything tastes like eggs and matzo meal.
But the truth is there's almost nothing better than matzah with butter with a little bit of salt on it.
It's true.
That sounds good. Yeah. I was wondering if you could have butter. You can have butter.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. And there's egg matzah. There's the egg matzah with the chocolate on it. Yeah. That's really good.
Hey, have you guys ever had shmura matzah?
Yes, that's great.
That's the best.
That is.
And what is it?
Do you know exactly what it is?
No, what is it exactly? Except better.
It's matzah that's handmade, mm-hmm. I think. I'm guessing.
Right.
And so it's not flat. It's like bumpy. Mm-hmm. But it's not bread that has height. It's just like this almost board. Imagine like a board that started to melt. So it would like start to get texture and mm-hmm. bend. But it also has a different taste. It mm-hmm. has this really like deep.
Almost smoky.
Yeah. Like almost starting to get burnt, but not mm-hmm. yet. And mm-hmm. the only place I know to get it is in New York City because like they're making it by hand, so there's like no money in it. You can't just make it in machines, and it's a different taste. I love it.
It's great. And there's sort of a thing that they you know the rabbis figured out that when does fermentation start? Like when does if you mix water and flour, when does it start to ferment? And they came up with 18 minutes. So anytime if you're the Streit's Matzah Factory, you have to make sure that from the time you put the water in to the time it's baked, it can't be more than 18 minutes. So that's what makes matzah, you know, kosher for Passover, is that 18-minute.
18 minutes, that's
18
so interesting.
18-minute deal. So, yeah, so there's,
you almost wonder if, you know, like 18 is high.
Right.
The 18 is the number in Hebrew that represents life. And because we attribute numbers and letters to the same thing, and it adds up to 18, mm-hmm. at which we consider to be life.
Right. So there's a mystical aspect to it as well.
So
now, what does anything happen at the synagogue?
Well, there are services the first two mornings. And actually, there are services every single day. There's the first 2 days and the last 2 days are considered holy days.
Okay.
And very special things happen on those. But we read the Torah traditionally on Saturday, Monday, and Thursday, which those used to be the market days. But during Passover, we read it every single day. And in special Torah readings. But the last day of Passover is actually this really wonderful day. The service includes what's called the Yisker service, which means to remember. He remembers. And it's a time for everybody to show up and remember their beloveds who are no longer with us.
Oh.
And we do that four times a year.
Four times a year. What other? So at Passover.
We do it at Passover, Shavuot, which is the holiday that's about 7 weeks from Passover, for Yom Kippur, our mm-hmm. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and then for Sukkot, at the end of Sukkot, which is the sort of harvest festival.
Okay. What's the one that's coming up in about 7 weeks?
Shavuot is the holiday that marks... So we left Egypt, and we crossed the Red Sea, big excitement, and then we wandered for a little bit for 7 weeks and ended up at Mount Sinai, and we got the Torah. And so we got the revelation. You know, that's why we were freed, so that we could get the laws to follow.
Mm-hmm. And it's a dairy holiday, isn't that the dairy? So that you traditionally eat, just to bring it back to food. You bring it because I'm really a baking Jew. That's my affiliation. And so you eat dairy foods. You eat blintzes. You eat cheesecakes, ice cream. You know, all those dairy foods are traditionally served.
And we wonder why we have high cholesterol.
Right, but yum. It is delicious.
Is there a connection?
I don't know. It's just tradition. It's just sort of what you do is. Is the dairy foods, and the one thing I remember from being a kid was that, not so much like, you go through, you eat your crumbly matzo sandwiches you're taking in your lunchbox and everything else, but bread has never tasted so good. You don't think a week is very long, but that first night, my mom would make garlic bread and spaghetti, and I just remember eating just a plain piece of bread, just tasted like heaven.
One of my friends just told me that his family's tradition is on the day after Passover, pizza dinner.
Right.
That's it. And everyone celebrates.
Right. But the taste of horseradish, when I have horseradish in anything else, I automatically, I don't know if it's for you too, but I automatically think of Passover. Yeah.
Now, why is there symbolic?
So the horseradish is the bitter herb.
Oh,
usually.
It's the bitter herb. Yeah, okay.
We got obsessive one year, and we have our own. We grow horseradish so that we can make our own.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And the entire world clears out of the kitchen while I do it with the food processor.
Special goggles.
Well,
you can actually, and you can buy horseradish.
Yes, you can buy it.
Yeah, you can buy it here. No, I just meant for people who are listening.
Yes,
they don't have time to grow it for tomorrow.
Right.
If they want to make their own, I know that Andy's Market almost always has it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially this time of year, they'll have it.
Yeah, so you can, and then you can plant it to grow it for next year.
Mm-hmm.
So do you use it other times of year?
No, it's just Passover fruit.
Okay. I know some people have to have it at Christmas.
Most Jews get so worried
that's
about.
That's true. Yes, but it was a Jewish woman who came to my house for Christmas because they hate Christmas, and I'm not real Christmassy. I just any excuse to have people around my table and eat and spend time together. Those are my holidays, whatever they are. And so friends from Berkeley who usually go to a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco for Christmas came up to my house and we had prime rib, and she brought fresh horseradish.
But that prime ribs and horseradish.
Yeah, prime ribs.
You got to have it there.
Just, goes together, definitely.
So will you have are there special roles for you as you are in the process of becoming a rabbi? Are there special things that you'll be doing for Passover? And maybe not.
Not
I don't
making
know anything.
well, no, we'll be having our family Seder with 18 of us. And I'll be, same things I normally do. Services Tuesday morning, so on.
I will not be making sponge cake because, despite my heritage of coming from a long line of amazing sponge cake makers, I cannot make sponge cake. But I've decided that everyone really doesn't want sponge cake. They want flourless chocolate cake. And so that's what I make.
Flour, yes.
I'm not a big chocolate fan, so we're going to have almond orange cake.
Ooh, that sounds delicious. Yeah. That sounds
New York
great.
Times recipe.
Right, because a lot of times you eat a lot of nut cakes because things that use nut basically nut flours, instead of grain flours.
Now, can they use eggs?
Yes. In fact,
so you can make things that rise with eggs.
Yes, vast quantities of eggs are consumed.
Yeah, we cheat in major ways. So we're creative.
Yes, you can make a souffle.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. A lot of eggs.
And we even have matzah cake meal.
Right, which is matzah flour really, really fine. There's also potato starch that gets used too.
Yeah, I think I've seen matzah cake meal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing that we were maybe going to talk about on Mouthful today, but we're not, except for a little tiny bit, is the book that Congregation Shomrei Torah put out, I think, last fall. You brought it. Oy to Joy.
That's such a great title.
Yes, you did bring it, because I wrote about the book a few weeks ago in my column, and I thought for Passover, I just, on my blog, I'd put a link to the column. Were you involved with that?
Can you describe what it is? It's a cookbook, right?
It's a cookbook.
It's a cookbook, but it's a beautiful cookbook.
Yeah, I'm going to hand it to you to look at, Stephanie. It's recipes from people in the congregation, and the members, some are members of the community as well, right? Not necessarily members of the congregation.
Santa Rosa,
it has two lovely black and white cookies. It has sort of a face, but it has adorable little black and white cookies as the eyes on the cover. And here we have everything from Cabernet braised beef short ribs to, the brisket, everybody's, you know, grandma's favorite.
There's some very interesting recipes, very unusual things from the Middle East, some interesting things from Africa.
Right. Oh, this looks fantastic. This looks really great. Definitely much more, you know, up to date than what we would think of as a, you know, religious organization's cookbook.
Now, you have another one.
I brought another one, which is my Road of Shalom's Sisterhood's cookbook, which is older. But it's got some interesting, actually it's got some of the same recipes because there's someone who is a member of both congregations.
I just did an African salad.
Right. But it also has the recipe for how to make a perfect hard-boiled egg.
Really?
Which is an important thing.
Which is really worth Passover, yes, because you traditionally
have. Do you know it by heart?
Actually, I do. Because it's I got it from, it's you cold water, water to cover, boil them. From the moment of boil, turn on your timer for 4 minutes. Turn it off, let them sit for 4 minutes, cold water and peel.
That's very close. I do mine just a tiny bit differently, but that's very close. Very close. I had an interesting egg today. I think I have just enough time to tell you at the Iron Horse Vineyards event. Christopher Greenwald was doing his version of eggs sous vide, and he lined ramekins, and you actually did it yourself. There were ramekins lined with plastic wrap, and then there were four different infused oils, and you put some infused oil into the plastic wrap. I chose ancho chili oil. Then you break your nice local hen's egg into it, gather it up. Oh, put some salt. He had a selection of salts. I chose the smoked salt. Gather it up, tie it really tight, and then put it into a water bath of 200 degrees.
Still in the ramekin or just the plastic?
No, just so you pull it up. You tied it and then pulled it out of the ramekin and set it in the plastic wrap. And it took about 6 to 7 minutes. And one of the things was nice, when you turn it out, you turn it over onto a piece of toast and then peel off the plastic, the shape is perfect, and the texture of the white was really, really wonderful. Mine could have gone 1 minute less. They kept saying, no, it's not done yet. Could have gone 1 minute less for the yolk to be perfect, but it was still very good. I was impressed. I thought it was excellent.
Sounds lovely.
Yes, it was. And on that note, we are out of time here on Mouthful. Is there a traditional greeting for Passover? A wish?
Chag Sameach. Well, Chag Pesach Sameach, which means
Chag Pesach Sameach,
which means Happy Passover holiday.
Oh, so Happy Passover! You can say Happy Passover without offending someone.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, please say it to everyone.
Okay. Well, thank you, and Happy Passover to both of you. Thank you so much for sharing a Sunday evening with me. My guests have been Meredith Kahn and Stephanie Rosenbaum, and also Eric Black. Thank you so much for your contribution. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the One Country's Most Delicious Hour. Michelle and Jordan, have a great week.
To the Lord, let the praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said.
Mouthful is produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. It's engineered by Lawrence Alberti and Eric Black. For more information about Mouthful, email to catsmilk@sonic.net. That's catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also go to krcb.org and download podcasts of Mouthful, as well as from iTunes.
And the moral of this story, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too. And he'll sing,
to the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says. It's time for dinner now, let's go. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says.
To the Lord, let praise be.
Let it be.
It's time for dinner now, let's go.
We got some beans
and good cornbread.
Good cornbread.
Listen to what the preacher says.
To the Lord, let praises be.
Praise
be. It's time for dinner now, let's go.
We got some beans
and good cornbread.
Listen to me.